Welcome, everyone, to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me today is...
Scotty Hertz back in the zone. I got my 7 microphones lined up, ready to rock. But yes, the voice is back.
The voice is back. That's good. No, that wasn't too bad last week.
Yeah.
Faker. That was fake news.
It didn't sound like I was in the basement enough. I need to go down into the root cellar. That's next time I'll be like... Anyway, I survived. I'm back. You know, it's that time of the year.
It is that time of the year.
Wash your hands,
people. And this is the time for Open Sources, which is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today, we head to Montreal, where the Me Too wave has hit Concordia hard with multiple allegations against professors in the creative writing department. But is this just the tip of the iceberg? I think it is. And then an 11-year-old girl reported that she was attacked by a smiling Asian man with scissors, except it never happened. What kind of permanent harm is this going to do next time someone reports an actual hate crime? And then finally, there's a case before the Supreme Court of Canada that could give First Nations more of a say in lawmaking in this country. Shouldn't that be an important step in truth and reconciliation anyway? So that gets us to our first topic, which actually was one of our dumpster wrecks of the year, if you recall from our award show a few weeks back. But it's the monster that won't stay dead. That is the Phoenix Pay System. And this week, it seemed to go to a whole other level because... Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, tomorrow is the deadline if you're a government employee who has been overpaid or and have received a remuneration you perhaps aren't due. It is your deadline tomorrow to phone that into the pay center so that you do not take a penalty. And there was a CBC report this week that the software used to implement the Phoenix Pay System was, shall we say, bug-riddled. And I think the exact term was deliberately customized to basically fail.
Yeah, I think the exact quote was a cascade of pay errors. And that's never good.
No. Well, a cascade of anything on computers isn't good.
No, and it has come out that we found out more than what we knew before about what was going on. A couple of things, a few things actually, that it would seem that the main error was that the system was customized to default everybody to the lowest pay rate. So even if you were at another level, now you have to keep in mind that there was about 80 collective agreements and like a few hundred thousand workers in the system. So there's a lot of specifics, and you know, you could be doing the job in Toronto and it might be different pay scale from somebody in Guelph, or they've made you a separate offer to keep you, that kind of thing.
Or if you're transferring departments too, you wouldn't start at the lowest pay scale in that department. No. If you're transferring from like fisheries and oceans to defense, let's say.
So it sounds like that's one of the main issues. So like I said, even if your letter or your offer letter said one thing, you got another, until somebody went into the system and made a manual change. And of course, all of that, supposedly it's something like half a million of that alone.
Half a million
changes involving over 150,000 workers.
Right.
And it sounds like they've gone back to not quite prehistoric times, but Excel, like it's 1995 or something, and it sounds like the default legal pad and pen and paper is how they're doing a lot of the calculations and then crunching it that way. And of course, I think I had mentioned it before, this pretty much all started when they decided to get rid of about 1,000 people that handled payroll at the government level under the Harper government. It's something we don't say too often. We used to say it every day. Now we don't say it anymore. So cutbacks to the Harper government, laid off 1,000 people and centralized the system in the Miramichi. And it would seem the other interesting thing that came out that I found was everybody arrived, and the day it started, it was kind of like nobody knew how to run the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking of that. Was it Hidden Figures, where nobody knows how to work the IBM and the punch cards are there, and everybody's like, I don't know. So she goes to the public library and gets the book. That's what it sounded like. It was like they were handed something. He's like, well, you guys do payroll. You should be able to know. You should know how to do this. And that was like, actually, we have no idea.
I think that's the same story with it comes to a lot of big government changes, that the day comes, the changeover happens, and then nobody knows what the change looks like, which is unfortunate because, you know, for those of us that do believe in good governing and good government and that, you know, believe that public service is worthwhile service, this is the kind of thing that makes you, you know, hit your head on the desk. That, you know, we can't, you know, pay people. You know, this is kind of the...
It's pretty basic stuff, right?
It's basic stuff. It's also...
Why do we work? So you get the check, right?
Right. And it, but it's also the biggest part of the government. Like, the biggest part of any business is paying the people. And so this is a pretty, you know, costly thing. This is like a money pit. And it's, you know, 2 years on now from when it started implementation. And it's, you know, yeah, it started under the Harper government. But, you know, there comes a point where you can't dump a problem on the previous government anymore if you haven't been able to solve it in 2 years. And I think that's the biggest thing working against the Trudeau government. I mean, this is a real scandal, honestly. Not like we're Trudeau and on vacation, which I still don't care about, but this is like really affecting people's lives. And CBC profiled one gentleman by the name of Jerome Marty, who, according to him, he's been overpaid $25,000 because he quit working for Fisheries and Oceans in 2016, but he was still getting paid well into 2017. And he's, you know, tried to deal with this several times. And it isn't working. It's going to affect his pension plan. It's going to affect his RSP contributions. You know, he has this $25,000 sitting in the bank, and he can't go out and buy a new car with it, because eventually someone's going to come calling looking for it. And he goes to the government and says, hey, I have $25,000 that you guys overpaid me. And they look it up on the computer like, no, we didn't. And he's like, well, that's nuts, because I kind of know how my own personal finances work. Meanwhile, him and thousands of others trying to call that stupid hotline, and hotlines are jammed because the deadline is tomorrow. So it's a real gong show.
Yeah, if I understand it right, it's crashed a couple of times, or you're just, you know, your call is important to us. Is it really? It sounds like there's about 59,000 people in the overpayment system. It sounds like, what was it, $228 million worth of underpaid, mm-hmm. and $295 million overpaid, something like that. There's like a massive chasm between the two amounts there, and trying to sort that out is obviously going to take bodies. The 1,000 people that were laid off are probably going to have...
Well, they hired 300.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, probably doesn't put much of a dent in it.
And but I think it would have been fresh blood as well, because it sounds something else that had happened with this when they consolidated. It sounds like a lot of the 1,000, and it's like anything, if you're getting laid off and you know it's not your job anymore, do you really care? So it would also sound like a lot of the files, like the paper files or whatever was left, didn't necessarily make it down to the new office. So that, again, another wrinkle in the whole system. If there was somebody that was particularly bitter that had a lot of banker's boxes, then there's gonna be real trouble. So again, but that's a bit of the blame game too. It's like, oh, it's you. But it sounds like, you know, perfect storm kind of stuff. But the main thing is that this system was a lemon from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And how do you sort it out? You know, do you sort it out with this massive Excel spreadsheet? Maybe, but that's not sustainable at all.
No, but
I'm not really sure what the plan is in terms of, like, do they just keep chipping away at Phoenix? Do they introduce something new?
It makes you wonder, though, because
that horizon, so.
Yeah, because I hear a lot of alliteration about the problems. I don't hear anything like I don't know if anyone's ever asked them, like, something along the effect of, like, if you get a new operating system for your computer, like you download the latest version of Windows and put it on your computer and it doesn't work and it's buggy, you can revert back to the old one. Like, can they do that for the pay system? Like, can they, you know, when this thing, I mean, probably not now, But as this thing was starting to crap out, I mean, obviously right away, as it started to crap out, they couldn't have gone back to the old system. Like, there wasn't an old computer or server with the right software on it.
Well, it sounds like it was all parceled out. So if you have pay systems that are regional, it can be difficult to consolidate them. And I bet you there were probably places, maybe smaller departments or ones with not as much money, that would have had older tech. Because I was, you know, a lot of years ago, I worked in tech, and some of the stuff we got back was from like the 60s. So every once in a while, like an office would close and they would clear everything out and send it back, not realizing it was still on lease. And it'd be like, really? This is what you were running? But the thing is, if it works, you know, if it is tractor feed paper, and if it is, you know, I mean, I know it's everything needs to be emailed out now, and there's, you know, no one cuts checks anymore generally, then, you know, it's quite possible a lot of those systems were so antiquated that they didn't quite make the cut. Now, mind you, I was reading this morning, sort of a related story. Did you see that article about the performance pay? There's about 75 million doled out. I can bet you that none of that is wrong. Like, none of the performance pay for the management, the people, presumably some of them might be those that are the talent that they're trying to retain to correct this issue.
Sure.
I would guarantee that their paychecks are probably okay. What payroll system are they using? You know, why don't they adapt that? They might not be on Phoenix if they're management. It might be something else.
Well, there's a couple of things wrong with this, and normally I don't care about this, but I mean,
$75 million. I mean, that's,
I'm one of those people who doesn't care about the Sunshine List. I don't care.
No,
but something like the optics of this is all wrong because in the midst of this crisis of like the workers, the frontline workers who seem to be getting screwed their pay, because even if you're overpaid, you're still kind of screwed. You're still forced to like have this amount of money hanging around your bank account until they figure out what the heck's going on. Being underpaid is worse, but being overpaid is no fun either. You have this crisis. You have the fact that all these execs got a pay increase that's twice that of the average of the frontline workers who've been, you know, negotiated through unions of, you know, such and such percent increase every year. This was more than twice that. And, I mean, there's just always the icky political optics of, you know, managers and executives getting big bonuses, and that's not something people like to see in government. And I just, the Phoenix stuff, you know, takes it to a different level of just, like, it's gross. It's gross is what it is.
Yeah, I would say no bonuses for the Phoenix people until it's fixed. And then maybe that would take away the incentive for them to do it. But it is the optics of the thing. It's like, well, their people aren't getting paid, then they probably shouldn't either. So,
yeah, I mean, it's,
is that fair? I don't know, but
well,
you get a bonus for doing a good job. Then maybe somebody out there is doing a good job trying to put this right. But why? Well, it's dumpster wreck extraordinaire. I certainly hope that, you know, this time next year we're not still talking about this.
Oh, for sure.
Possibility, but I sure hope not. I think they need somebody, you know, like their Churchill to come in and go, okay, this is how it's going to be. But yes, Phoenix, you're looking for your Churchill.
This is just such a movie show because we started with Hidden Figures and now we're at Darkest Hour.
What can we roll into next?
Well, oddly enough, we are heading into the realm of creative writing. Concordia University, you may know it. It's in Montreal. Some of you may have gone there or may know people who go there. But there was a report last week, and this is sort of in keeping with everything that's going on about Me Too, Time's Up, all that, that there were several professors in the English department there, particularly the creative writing department, who were basically taking advantage of female underclass students, undergrad students, and that a couple of professors have been sort of pulled from the roster, and an investigation is underway. But this is one of these open secrets that we've been hearing about, and the president of Concordia, Alan Shepard, says it may have been an open secret, but it wasn't, certainly wasn't open to him, and a lot of people are calling BS on that.
Yeah, this is one of those things where, and it's interesting that it took a man that was in the department and also kind of admitted to, yeah, I probably, you know, I had a, how did he put it? I've read the essay. It was pretty good. It was fairly well written. Right. I'm trying to remember the name of the title, but it was something like not canlets full of monsters. I will recall it before the end of the bit. But yeah, he sort of wrote this confessional, and then all of this other stuff starts leaking out. And it sounds like this is a 30-year arc, so it's not as if no one knew. And I'm not sure how I thought Shepard was a newer president there, Dr. Shepard. Mm. But what I thought was odd, part of his statement was that the sexual harassment and violence policies specific to Concordia are a work in progress. And anytime I hear that, that means it's probably non-existent.
It's at the beginning of the work.
you would get it from the website on a PDF and it would have draft stamped on it. That's what that tells me. But it also sounds an interesting aside to this, but directly related, is that it sounds like the Quebec government, I'm not sure if it's an extension of this, sounds like they're going to pass there's a bill in the works in Quebec that's going to pass guidelines for student faculty intimacy. And supposedly it's going to be hopefully established by September 2019, which seems very far away, but at least it's it's happening. I thought, wow, this is all an offshoot of this. So at least, you know, the provincial government there is taking some sort of steps. That alone, if that's all that's in the bill, will not solve this, because when you have a toxic culture like that, it's very difficult to unwind when you have embedded people in a closed system and all of those things. Now, it sounds like somebody that was involved, because Stephen Hennigan, not involved, is a prof here, but he went to Concordia at the time, and he wasn't afraid to name names. I can't remember where the report was. But he said he mentioned somebody named Robert Allen, now deceased, who in particular, he said that the toxic environment kind of emerged from that.
Yeah.
He either lost his wife or got divorced. And then this evolved. I don't completely believe that. I think that the essence of that has to be there. All of the factors in place where you can run a closed shop like that. And everybody kind of going along with it, as Mike Spry did, as he mentioned in his essay.
Mm-hmm. Well, even Spry isn't blameless in this,
no.
Because his ex-girlfriend, Julie McIsaac, like, you know, she posted like a counter narrative that said, well, he was part of the problem, too. He was one of these people who was also taking advantage of female undergrad students as well. So it's funny that he should be the whistleblower on this, because it almost seems like... he was trying to get ahead of it, like, you know, it was
kind of like Spurlock.
Yeah.
Kind of said, oh, I did this.
Right.
Don't kill me. But he does admit to it. Did you read the essay or did you see it?
No, I just read the details of it.
It was, I think it was called the website is called Canlit Accountable.
Right.
Because I know that wasn't there a movement, was it UBC, was that called UBC Accountable as well, regarding Stephen Galway, a similar department but on a different side of the country.
Right.
And that's the one that was in the news this week as well, because they were giving Margaret Atwood, I think, was in a Twitter battle because she was one of the signatories to, like, don't judge this guy yet. And then it turned out, I guess, in the investigation, at least according to the investigation, that nothing untoward happened. I think other people are saying something else, but there was 100 signatories. I think Vincent Lam, there was a lot of like names that you would recognize in Canlit signed this letter, but Margaret Atwood in particular has been one of the ones that was vocal and wrote up. It was a Globe Mail article.
Yeah,
I guess,
she wrote an op-ed.
She was taking flack for that. I'm a bad feminist. And then,
That's
of course,
right.
Margaret Wente piles on as well. And yeah, I don't read anything she writes at all.
Famous plagiarist, Margaret Wente.
Yeah, so it's, you know, there's some battle royals going on about this. But as to what's the latest with Concordia other than Shepard running defense?
Well, there was somebody else today that there was another accusation. About this happening, it's
at Concordia or another?
No, at Concordia. Yeah. This is all Concordia related. Of course, I want to shout out to something that happened on here on the Guelph campus this week too. And it's an anthropology first year anthropology class where it looked like a professor was abusing a student in front of the whole class. That seems to have been perhaps overblown, because there's some people on the social media saying, you know, they were there and it was bad, but it wasn't, you know, perhaps job killing as some people seem to be wanting in the case of this professor. So, I mean, and this has nothing to do with sexual misconduct either. This was just, you know, seemed to be a misunderstanding, and this professor getting maybe a little too hot under the collar to considering the space.
Yeah, so I think most people know the story probably, but what happened was there was a student with special needs, anxiety problems, and they had an assistant, and it sounded like, at least the quotes were, again, unverified. I would assume that somebody probably recorded the lecture, so there may be evidence to that effect. Mm-hmm. Referred to the assistant as the handler.
Yeah.
And, you know, as much livestock by the sounds of it. And then I guess this person was, you know, their anxiety was acting up and he was chipping at them a bit. But it sounds like half the class walked out. And I did see the short speech from the one young woman saying, you know, this is ridiculous. So there's obviously enough witnesses there to corroborate if something did happen. It sounds like it did. And there's no reason to believe that it didn't. But this... this sounds like one where they, like, you know, send you to the sensitivity training, or perhaps allow, you know, an apology at least, or some level of what I would call restorative justice, and that, like, you know, you accommodation is there, you have to do that; it's a requirement. And then for some reason, I started thinking about Jordan Peterson again and the whole pronoun thing, because it's along those lines. I think the kind of like, well, I, you know. Perhaps he was having a bad day. I don't know if this prof has a reputation.
People have bad days.
But you would think it's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, they will haul you in and say, look, you need to do this. But he's suspended, though, isn't he? Like,
I believe, yeah.
If I understand right, he was a sub as well. He was filling in for somebody. So it's not as if he was the regular prof.
He might be. And I think the class from last night was canceled.
Yeah. So they sort it out or find somebody. Probably. Right. Maybe they'll find an underpaid TA to...
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem here is, you know, that everybody's kind of gone to their corners on this, and perhaps, you know, we're kind of remembering it in different ways. I mean, yeah, I think you're right about there being some need for restorative justice here, that, you know, people get hung under the collar, and, you know, this seems to be a case like that. But to go back to Concordia, some of the descriptions that some of the people some of the young women, or perhaps not young women anymore, because some of this goes back to the 90s. So I don't understand how it was a quote-unquote open secret that never passed the ears of the president, and if he's been there for a while. But some of the descriptions of, like, you know, getting notes from professors to, like, have off-campus meetings or to go to their home or, you know, some place where it's, like, a little easier to... you know, to try, you know, quote unquote seduction. And, you know, one young woman talked about her experience of going to the home and having, like, there's like a nice little table setting for two, and he shows her to the bedroom, and it's just, you know, icky. And she talked about her, speaking of anxiety, her increasing anxiety being in this situation with her professor. And yeah, the troubling part is that it seemed to be par for the course that, you know, young women in the creative writing program were not there as students so much as they were there as, you know, potential bedmates. And of course, part of this is the culture too. I mean, how many TV shows and, you know, have there been where, you know, the male professor is seducing the female student? You know, it's like the kind of the Wonder Boys thing. It's part of the culture and that. Pop culture, I mean, and that kind of makes it okay, and the two kind of reinforce each other, so that even young women who've come out and I've heard read pieces by female writers are like saying it's, you know, when you're 20 years old and you're trying to figure yourself out and you know, it's being seduced by an older man, it's, you know, it's not necessarily in your front of your mind that this is necessarily a bad thing happening to you, you're being taken advantage of. But it is part of a real male dominant power structure that, you know, puts a kind of seal of approval on it too.
Well, and there's shades of the Hollywood situation in this as well, because it's the whole, if you don't go along with this and it's embedded in our culture, then you won't succeed. If you're an up and coming writer and you could be the best writer, you could be an okay writer.
Yeah.
It sounded like people, women in particular, but everybody, according to Spry's essay, wouldn't get published or even recognized if they didn't go along.
And it's very cliquey too.
And cliquey.
Yeah.
and closed. And, you know, it, once that kind of thing is embedded, because, yeah, something about the arts, eh? It's just like there's a bit of, well, not even a bit of the bending of the rules, but it's like, it sounds like this, like you say, 30 years, however far back, was well embedded. So it's not, once it's entrenched, it's like you need pretty much dynamite to let loose, or something like Me Too, Time's Up. And just as a point there, I looked it up, Alan Shepard, Concordia 2012 from U of T. And it says he had a leadership role at U of G, but I have no recollection of the guy, and I've been here for a while. So it may have been obviously not in a role where people would know his name. When they mentioned it, I thought he was the astronaut, actually. But he may be. Yeah, I know. This is Alan Shepard. But I think Alan Shepard might be long gone. But anyway, long gone from Guelph to this Alan Shepard. Professor Alan Shepard, we'll call him.
Yeah. So, I mean, more to come on this, obviously. This is far from over. And I think we're going to see. I mean, you know, this is sort of kicked off a couple weeks ago with the stuff coming out of Soul Pepper and the allegations against Albert Schultz. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes next. Before we take a break, I just want to read a bit from BuzzFeed on an unrelated issue. The headline is, Hungarian police have a warrant out for former Trump advisor Sebastian Gorka.
Ooh.
Now, you may remember Sebastian Gorka. He's a member of a Hungarian fascist party that had strong Nazi ties. And the article goes like this. Former Trump White House staffer Sebastian Gorka has an active warrant out for his arrest in Hungary, according to the Hungarian police's website. Gorka, whose exact role in the White House while serving as deputy assistant to the president was never entirely clear, apparently is in trouble with the law over a charge of, quote, firearm or ammunition abuse, unquote. The warrant, first posted in Hungarian online outlet 444, was issued on September 17th, 2016, prior to Trump's election. Now, during this period, Gorka met at the White House with President Trump in a meeting with Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó. So, here's wanted criminal immigrant Sebastian Gorka, and apparently the charge goes back to 2009. So much for extreme vetting. So this is kind of hilarious.
Yeah,
to
deport
me.
All the dreamers, but Hungarian fash, no problem. So
absolutely,
that sounds about par for the course with this. Administration down there, but yeah,
I just wanted to share that because we need a bit of a laugh after all that.
Take him down.
Anyway, we're going to take a break here and then come back after the break with two more issues to discuss. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Yes, the unmistakable voice of Dolores O'Riordan. That was a re-release of the Cranberries hit from the mid-90s. Released last year, they did an acoustic version of a lot of their songs. And as you know, Dolores O'Riordan passed away this week at the age of 46. I think reasons not quite determined yet. Mm. But yeah, it's always younger than me. So I'm like, oh boy. But yeah, definitely one of the voices of my youth and probably some of yours too. Are you a Xenial?
I don't even know.
I don't
anymore.
Know what I am anymore. Yeah,
I don't even know anymore.
A little
anymore.
Bit of a flashback for you there, folks. And I just want to mention, we still have the ticket giveaway. Two tickets to Guelph's own Pritam Sengupta at the River Run Center, February 2nd, 8 p.m., the Borealis Music Series. Give us a call. Two tickets, 519-837-CFRU, 519-837-2378. We believe our operator is still standing by, but if there's no reply, try calling again and somebody will entertain your call. And they are available, they are free and ready to go.
Free and ready to go.
A little bit of spin there.
So last Friday, there was an incident at a Toronto school, a young 11-year-old girl in a hijab. She reported that she had been attacked by an Asian man dressed in black, holding scissors, and smiling quite handily as he attacked her not just once but twice, trying to cut her hijab. The press was called. There was a nice little press conference. The police were on it. And then by Monday morning, it was revealed that the whole attack was not something that actually happened. And predictably, it's interesting that it happened the way it did. Not good that it happened the way it did, but it was interesting because I was on Twitter Sunday morning and I came across this tweet of somebody pointing out on the CBC, like, how did the CBC get this story up so fast? It happened at like 7 or 8 and then it was up at 9:30. It's like, it must be a hoax. It must be a fake. And I was just like, oh my goodness, really?
False flag.
This is where we are. Like, it's you can put up a story online if it's all text and you're like, pretty quick. It's like, trust, as some, let me tell you, as someone who knows, it's not that hard. It's
not these days.
Not these
back
days.
In the teletype days, it was a little tougher.
Yeah, it was a little tougher back in the day. But with web publishing, it's not that hard. And then, of course, on Monday, yeah, it did turn out to be fake. And I was kind of upset. And I think that we've seen a lot of anger directed at the family and at the little girl. Like, there are people who are saying, like, the little girl should be locked up. Without clearly not recognizing the fact you can't lock up an 11-year-old. But,
well, and then Ezra Levant took it one step further. Ezra, it's like, Levant, lock up the mother. The
oh, the
mother
hijab
should
hoax
go
mom?
To jail. Yeah. Is that what he's calling
the
her?
The hijab hoax mom?
I try and stay away from comment sections when something like this happens because you know where it's going to go.
Oh, yeah.
Right? If it was just, oh, yeah. If it was an 11-year-old that made something else up and wasn't necessarily wearing religious headgear, I think it might be a different story. But there was a few things that went, not strange here, but it is odd to have it didn't take them long to convene the press conference. And I think the Toronto District School Board were trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But therein is the problem in that they just, and, you know, they took her at her word, which is what you should do.
Yeah. I mean, we just did a segment about, you know, allegations. Yeah. And, you know, you should believe the victims.
Exactly. You should believe the victims. But then it sounds like there wasn't any further investigation. And then when this came out, here's my guess of something that may have led to this. For whatever reason, maybe this young woman has decided that this particular day she doesn't want to wear her hijab.
Yeah.
And you can come up with any scenario with a kid not wanting to do something, whatever, and they'll make something up, right? I'm sure we've all done it. Probably most of us, right?
Yeah.
And then maybe she thought Ma was going to get word that she wasn't wearing it for whatever reason. So you come up with a story, right? Mm-hmm. This happens all the time, every day, in every nation, right?
Yeah.
And that the sad part about this is that it shouldn't distract from all of the hate crimes that happen, and there's lots. It's not as if that they're faking it, and that's something else is going to come out too. It'll be like every single thing like this now is going to be, oh no, they just made it up. You know, the pig's heads in the mosque, and the graffiti on the mosque, very real, very common, happens a lot, but now it's going to be like, oh, it must be faking it. So they're just doing this to get attention. She's 11. Doesn't matter her faith or whatever. This is an 11-year-old. And I think they probably should have done a bit more digging before going to the press.
Well, the problem is that, it's all on the adults. It's, you know, there should have been a situation where between
the weeping school board member,
the daughter, the kid, and the parents, and the family came out and said, issued a statement. It's like, you know, we were just as surprised as everyone else. We showed up to school, and then we were told this story, and we had no reason not to believe it.
Yeah.
The problem here was, I think, obviously, the school and the school board who turned this into, I don't know if they were trying to turn it into a quote-unquote teachable moment or what they were trying to do, but it was an obvious and immediate overreaction on the part of the school, I think.
Yeah.
Because I don't think the reaction should have been, let's hold a press conference immediately. I mean, whose thought was that? Like, we need to have an immediate press conference instead of just going to the police and letting the police decide in what way this should be handled, because I think the police might have handled a bit differently. Otherwise, the police certainly would have held a press conference about it. They would have seen what usually happens, which is like a scrum outside police headquarters with the media person for the police. But the school board turned this into a show.
Yeah, and the media person, the press officer, was there.
Yeah.
Like, the cop that does that spoke. I mean, what do you do? You can't not say something, I suppose. The police are saying that they didn't organize it. The Toronto District School Board is saying they didn't organize it.
Somebody organized it.
And maybe that's why they're trying to lay it on the parents or the
press
mother.
Conferences don't just happen.
Yeah, and I don't think the mother did. So was it somebody at the school? Was it somebody... Who knows?
I would be very surprised if the mother did.
Yeah. So with the power of Twitter, maybe someone's like, hey, this is happening. And then everybody just
pounced. I think the majority of parents' immediate reaction upon hearing their child's attack would be, okay, let me take my child home and get out of here. Not, let's put my child on display.
And it went international, too. I saw it on The Guardian before I even saw it on the CBC. So I was like, wow, this has got some wheels. So whoever did... sent out the call did a really good job, because it's like, you can be difficult to get that much media there so quickly. So that's what makes me think it's somebody in the know, as opposed to, to try and organize a press conference if you have never done it before. It's a challenge, as you know.
Yeah. It's a shock. I mean, it was a shocking story, so I understand why it went around like it did. But it's, I get the sense that the police would have handled it a different way. Because if you've ever seen a police officer, press person, do a, like a, one of those spots on TV, that there's a very specific way they describe the situation. Yeah, it's cop speak. It's very specific. It's very neutral. It's very impartial. And the victim is never there.
No.
So...
this was odd.
This was not the police way of proceeding things. And I think once you kind of eliminate the parents through the logic and the police through their procedures, it does kind of leave one.
Yeah. It's usually pending further investigation, or whether there are the code words in there, you're right. So, and the Globe came out with an op-ed pretty quickly, and it was the main theme was, our compassion must not waver, which sounded like kind of like Churchill as well. Our compassion must not waver, but, and they're correct in that.
Little hippy dippy for the Globe.
Yeah, exactly. So I wonder about the Globe sometimes. Other times I do not. But so, and they're right in saying that. And it's like, it must, you can't, as I said off the top there, we can't really ignore all the other, because I mean, we'll say it's the pre-Trump era, but probably the main driver of the thing. That kind of crime is up 250%, like across the board. So it's not as if, and it is crime. Do not forget that. That's, unacceptable anywhere against anyone because of their faith.
Right. It's so, I mean, that is sort of top of my mind too. How much harm is this going to do? Because it certainly wasn't the little girl's intention to do harm. She just didn't want to go to school on a Friday or whatever. But because there are people like Ezra Levant out there and places like the Western Journal, which is a thing, who said that Trudeau has refused to condemn the family because
you must condemn them.
Yeah.
You're in cahoots with them.
And all these sort of right-leaning places, this is what they think, that Islamophobia is a thing that's made up, and that that there are no hate crimes, and that the only hate comes from people who wear headscarves. So I mean, in the end, this kind of does more harm than good. Again, not that it was the intent of the little girl to do harm, but certainly the hysterics, I think, of the school and the school board have definitely done more harm than good.
I can tell you, if you Google Ezra Levant and hijab, you get like 28,000 hits. So the guy's like a little bit obsessed.
He's got a problem.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Not 28 hits or 280, 28,000. So seems he has a lot to say on that.
And
none of it good.
No.
Zero.
And the other unfortunate bit of this comes like on the heels of the anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting. If you want to see, Islamophobia in work, this mosque in Quebec City, suffered this tragedy, which everybody rightly condemned the action of the person who did the shooting, but this is the same mosque that's had trouble getting acquiring land for a Muslim cemetery.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah.
So
we don't want it in our neighborhood.
Yeah, so, you know, everyone agrees that shooting a mosque is bad, but giving Muslims a place to bury their dead is... Or not giving Muslims a place to bury their dead, that's okay.
The struggle continues.
Yep. The struggle continues, and 500 years and counting for the members of our First Nations.
Yeah.
Although there is some reason for optimism on their part. There is a case before the Supreme Court right now. They heard the arguments this week. The plaintiff is the Mikisew Cree First Nations. They are in northern Alberta, and they have brought a case toward the Supreme Court that they were not given a chance to have input on changes to the Fisheries Act, the Species at Risk Act, the Navigable Waters Protection Act, and the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act. These legislation was all changed in omnibus bill under the government of... Stephen Harper, who...
That's two Harper mentions.
Yeah, it's a good week for Stephen Harper. I'm sure he wouldn't see it that way.
No.
But this case is interesting because it looks like if the Supreme Court rules in the favor of the Mikisew Cree, it may open up the doors for the governments of Canada to have to consult First Nations before changing legislation. And that has a real effect on the power dynamic in this country, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like the standard practice for years has been, probably since Confederation and probably before, is just to sort of have the government do what they were going to do, whether it's oil or you name it. It usually involves natural resources, fishing. They just do it and then worry about the scrap afterwards. It doesn't, you know, not looking at treaty rights and speaking to the people concerned. Now, interestingly, the first thing I found on this was the Ontario government's page on duty to consult.
Mm.
And had a read at it, and I'm thinking, yes, this sounds like what should happen, and we'll speak to this, and we'll speak to the tribal elders and the community. But then there's a little catch somewhere, and it says it's recommended but not always required.
Right.
So it's not... the law. And it sounds like this case with the Mikisew may change all of that at a constitutional level. So, of course, if it goes that high.
Yeah.
And what is the... It's Section 35, right? Now, it doesn't... It's not as... Section 35, if I understand it right, which is in relation to Indigenous people, I think at that point it was First Nations, almost didn't make the cut, if I understand it right, in the debates of 1982, still not on the radar even back then. There was obviously lots of outstanding treaty claims, still are lots of outstanding treaty claims, so something that's never, ever been solved and may never completely be solved. But so this may shape up to be a constitutional challenge, so if they set a precedent in this, then it's going to change the way... It will completely change the relationship between at least the federal government in this case... who the provinces answer to, and Indigenous people in Canada. And it seems there's a bit of a parallel case going on right now, something similar with the Mi'kmaq in PEI.
Yeah.
There was the PEI government sold a golf course to private hands. And, of course, the Mi'kmaq in the area saying, we never gave, ever gave this up. There's no treaty. We consider it ours. Because in lots of places, there are the Oka in particular, where there's treaty lands. There always seems to be the golf courses. I don't know. Because it's a massive swath of land, 325 acres, PI.
It's very Trump. It's always the golf courses.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Ask anybody in northern Scotland. So, again, relating to all the things you're talking about, like the land, water, what are the rights? And it's, you know, there's another example right away that connects to this. So that could effectively be changed as well if the case with the Cree goes through and proceeds in their favor, which I think that is going to take a while as well. This is just on the radar now, or is the decision coming down soon?
I don't know what the
it's one of those wheels are in motion.
But I mean, they heard the arguments this week. So the decision will come down at some point later. They do like to dig in and do their research and be deliberative. And it's worth noting that it's not unusual for the Supreme Court to side with First Nations either, although they don't always. But I think this is going to be particularly felt strongly, although there wasn't exactly widespread coverage of this Not that there's ever really widespread coverage of hearings at the Supreme Court. It's usually only when you get decisions that you hear about it. But yeah, it's kind of interesting because, well, you do have the Ontario government on the one hand saying, you know what, it's ideally our best practice is to consult the creation of the Alberta Energy Regulator, which this case kind of directly references, was created with the intention that they don't have to consult. That it's kind of like enshrined that there is supposed to be some kind of effort that if you're going into First Nations territory and doing something on their land, you talk to them, again, nation to nation kind mm-hmm. of thinking. But the AER was specifically created that, you know, you don't have to consult the First Nations. You just focus on the oil. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's been concerning the First Nations. So while there hasn't been, you know, there isn't always an effort to observe proper, let's call it diplomatic decorum in terms of dealing with First Nations.
Technically, this is diplomatic decorum, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nation to nation, right?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be.
Ideally. But, you know, this thing was created with very specific, like, you are about oil, you go get the oil, you don't care what the, in their thinking, Indians think, and you just go get it.
And sort it out later.
Sort it out later.
40 years later,
and,
you get
yeah, the Indians will just bucks. Have to groove on it, basically.
Yeah.
It's kind of galling, and it seems very backwards in its vision in terms of dealing with First Nations people. And where is all this oil? Well, it's in, like, northern Alberta, where nobody gave a crap about that land, which is why they gave it to the First Nations to begin with, until they discovered oil they could sell underneath of it.
Yeah, because it sounds, the counter-argument the government's putting forward is that if this happens, it's an intrusion.
Yeah.
And diminishes Parliament, I think was the exact quote. And it's putting people, we have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and this, if it happens, would put treaty rights above that.
I'm not sure how that's right, though, because
argument.
That's their argument, but I feel like Charter rights
they should be
are
parallel
more on
to each other, well, the sort of two-row approach. But,
well, my feeling on Charter rights is always it's more individualistic or like small groups. Like if you're part of a racialized group, if you're part of a group with a significant language difference or religious difference, it doesn't apply to it applies to the whole country, but how it protects you on an individual basis.
Yeah, but they're talking about the basic rights of freedom of speech, but also freedom, right to shelter and that kind of stuff.
I don't think that, but I don't think, I'm not a lawyer.
No.
First of all, I'm
That's
not
why
a
we're
lawyer.
Here. I'm not a lawyer. I just play on the radio. I'm just talking about legal things.
But I'm not sure how nation to nation, you know, dealing with the First Nations, like overrides, you know, freedom of the press and freedom of speech and all that. But that would have to be dumbed down to, again, law and order levels of legal understanding for me.
Yeah, and that's always that's always a different level of legal, right? It's like every once in a while, like, jurisprudence, what are they talking about? You got to Google it while you're watching the show. But I haven't watched Law & Order in ages. But
dumb this down so that I can watch a law episode of Law & Order and understand what's going on.
But yeah, and again, like the main beef was with the Harper bills, like you said, they just went, bam, it's going to be like this. And it covered, that's the problem with omnibus bills, that they cover so much that it's difficult to unravel sometimes if they're just, and you know, Harper government leaned very heavily on omnibus bills. They were jamming all kinds of stuff there. So we're just going to do this because it's efficient. You know,
that's how they put it.
It's like combining the payroll system. It creates efficiencies. We can lay people off and we'll just have one bill instead of 30. And why should we waste our time? And then of course, probably, try and shut the debate down so everybody can go to the cottage for the weekend kind of stuff, right? I mean, that's how long we talk about it. Like, okay, we'll give it a couple hours, if that, and then it's going to pass because we have a majority. Wah. So, but yes, so...
That was a great summation of 10 years of Harper, by the way.
It's true, though. Is there some truth to that? I know it's an opinion piece, but my goodness, it was pretty well how they rolled, right? So...
Well, and
just do this and damn you all.
Right. And there's a lot of stuff pending, too. You mentioned the case out east. There's also a case involving Fort McKay First Nations. The AER is they're taking the AER to court because there's an oil sands project near their ancestral homeland. There's two relatively big lakes that might be affected if they're going to be digging for oil. in that area. So that's going to be a court challenge. And you know what? If the Supreme Court comes back with a decision while that's still in motion, that's going to have a big effect. And on top, I mean, make no mistake, I mean, this is not getting a lot of, you know, corporate media coverage, but there are a lot of people with eyes on this. There's several First Nations groups and provincial attorneys general who are interventors in this. Mm-hmm. So basically they're, you know, they're yeah. people not directly part of the court case, but are being brought in to sort of testify and talk about it. They're basically witnesses, but like at a Supreme Court level. So they get the intervener's label. Again, my legal understanding is law and order level, so I'm not sure if I define that right.
The sound like, dun, dun.
But, clunk, clunk. Dun, dun. But, oh, jeez.
I was going and then you get the head now, don't you?
Yes. But, yes, Law and Order SVU 18 years
so
ago.
So completely
by the way.
Derailed that. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine. The thing is that everybody has a stake in this. First Nations across the country have a stake. Provincial governments have a stake, and people are definitely aware that this is going to change things up. No matter how it's decided, I think obviously people have their sides, but this is something to watch. And I think that's why we brought it up is, you know, because it is something worth watching. And even though our corporate media friends would rather talk about Smoke and Tony's barbecue closing.
Oh, yeah. We will revisit this. And I should just mention, I believe the tickets have been given away. So
yes.
Congratulations to the person or persons who got them.
Yes.
February 2nd, River Run.
Yes, we don't know who, so we can't let
congratulations to you.
Congratulations to, yes. That's it for the show. So if you want to find us online, you can go to opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And you can hear this and past episodes of the show on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can find us through iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play as well. You can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson or go to GuelphPolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog on occasion at spannerbook.wordpress.com. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to go home and watch Planet of the Teddy Bears, I think. Maybe I'll write a review. Right. What's that film you love?
Listen to the Star Wars end credits episode
great
for that
stuff,
reference.
Great stuff.
DJ Sounds Good to Me is here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. US
Just a note, it is actually a rebroadcast from January the 4th. May the 4th.
DJ Sounds Good to Me?
Yes. Sounds good to me.
So, all right.
May the rebroadcast of January 4th be with you.
Having said that, we'll see you next week, Thursday at 5. We'll be right back.